We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Inflation comes in hotter than expected for the third straight month, staying more persistent than the Federal Reserve and the White House had hoped at 3.5% for the last year. The figure jolted financial markets, which may not now get the early cuts in interest rates that they have been anticipating. We'll talk about the implications of this inflation news for the economy and for the 2024 election. Welcome, I'm Paul Gigot with the Wall Street Journal opinion page here on our Potomac Watch podcast, and I'm here with Mary Anastasia O'Grady and Joe Sternberg. Welcome to you both. So the CPI data, Consumer Price Index, one of several price index, came in at 0.4%. for March, third month in a row that it was hotter than expected, and therefore stopping the progress down from the peak of 9.1% that inflation reached towards the Federal Reserve's target of 2% annual inflation. Mary, what do you make of the figures?
Well, they're going in the wrong direction, Paul. That's the first thing to observe here. Although I think it's a little early to panic. Jay Powell never said that he was going to deliver six interest rate cuts, 25 basis points apiece. A more moderate expectation was three. It looks like we may not even have three this year. There's some question about whether there'll be one and whether it will come in June or maybe in November after the election. But he has said all along that he's going to look at the data and he is going to hold off cutting until he sees the whites of their eyes, you know, the actual drop in inflation to that 2% number. So everything is pretty much in line. I think what's surprising is that the tighter interest rate regime that he has had in place for almost going on 2 years now has not slowed the economy to the extent that the inflation pressures came off. So there's still robust job growth, even if it's part-time jobs, and companies are still earning profits. So for those reasons, I think he's just got to sit tight where he is and keep waiting.
Well, let's put that in his own words. Here's Chairman of the Fed, Jay Powell.
On inflation, it is too soon to say whether the recent readings represent more than just a bump. We do not expect that it will be appropriate to lower our policy rate until we have greater confidence that inflation is moving sustainably down toward 2%. Given the strength of the economy and progress on inflation so far, we have time to let the incoming data guide our decisions on policy. Of course, that outlook is still quite uncertain, and we face risks on both sides. Reducing rates too soon or too much could result in a reversal of the progress we've seen on inflation and ultimately require even tighter policy to get inflation back to 2%. But easing policy too late or too little could unduly weaken economic activity and employment.
So there's a noncommittal statement. He's looking at the data, Joe. But I think one of the interesting questions in the markets now, I've been following for some time, is just whether financial conditions are as tight as the Fed has been thinking, and whether its monetary policy is as tight as Chairman Powell has been saying at his various press conferences. I mean, if you look at the financial conditions as measured by prices across the economy of stock markets since the last week of October, at least before this week, had really had a tremendous run, and a tremendous run-up and increase. Gold price has been up. Oil is now hitting $85 a barrel or so, and is up. Commodities like copper, which indicate economic strength and demand, also up. Now, maybe that's the electronic EV vehicle subsidies. I don't know. But Mr. Copper, as they say, is often cited by a lot of market analysts to indicate a strong economy. And of course, the economy has been growing faster than people expected. What do you think, Joe?
I think that that is a really important question that gets to the core of the problem that the Fed and the rest of us face here, this issue of what actually are financial conditions right now? Are things tight? Or are they loose? And the way the Fed has been thinking about this problem is that part of it is this old trade-off that they assume exists between the labor market and inflation. And so from that perspective, they might still be concerned that conditions are not tight enough. But I think that the more important thing that they're aiming at here is that they assume that there's kind of like this underlying natural rate of interest that kind of exists out there in the wild, where if interest rates were at that level, everything would be completely neutral. The economy would grow at a healthy clip, but you wouldn't have any inflation. So they're asking themselves, are we above that level and tight, or are we below it and loose? And I think that what they haven't caught up to is the fact that that level can shift. And in fact, it might actually be that that rate is higher than they have been assuming, which would then actually mean that their policy is looser than they thought it was. And that would definitely be consistent with some of what we're seeing in the economy right now. I mean, some of the developments we've had, like a reasonably healthy labor market and, you know, a bunch of quarters of reasonably healthy GDP growth, suggests that actually the economy is chugging along very healthily, that American entrepreneurship and productivity are doing their things and potentially boosting prosperity for ordinary households. But then you also have this issue of inflation, which is suggesting that something is going haywire somewhere in the system. And I think that the real problem is that the Fed itself doesn't understand where we are on that continuum. But if you have inflation, that tends to suggest that things are a bit looser than their models seem to think that they actually are.
All right, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about some of the economic issues at play here, but also the political impact of inflation as the election approaches when we come back.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with the Wall Street Journal here on our Potomac Watch podcast with Mary Anastasio Grady and Joe Sternberg. They're talking about the dilemma of the Fed, Mary. The Fed always has these difficulties interpreting data, finding out where we stand. One of the difficulties that's been focused on here, and one of the reasons I think the Fed would like to reduce interest rates, is a problem in the banking system, particularly commercial real estate loans, which is a hangover from the pandemic and has affected a lot of mid-sized banks, we know. That's one issue. Some of the banks, as we saw with the Signature Bank failure a year ago, have duration risk from having the sudden increase in interest rates, put the assets they hold as losses if they had to market, which of course they don't, but still that hangs over them. So the Fed likes to see those rates come down, quite apart from mortgage rates and the other costs that go with high interest rates.
Well, yeah, I think you're exactly right. I mean, the big concern for a lot of people has been the problem with commercial real estate. The pandemic changed a lot the way particularly urban areas look and operate. And, you know, a lot of companies are stuck with these buildings that are empty. They can't sell them. They borrowed against them. And the Fed was hoping, I think, as I think most economists were hoping, that interest rates would come down and those owners could refinance at lower rates. And as that idea gets pushed out further and further on the timeline, it raises the risk that at some point some of these owners are just going to hand the keys back to the bank and walk away. And that would obviously cause a lot of problem in the financial system. It kind of surprises me on the duration question, how banks could have such a big mismatch, if there indeed is one, in the regional and the smaller banks. I don't think it exists in the bigger banks. That's been a problem before. And you would think that regulators would be on the lookout for that, but obviously they weren't in the case of the California bank that had so many problems, Silicon Valley Bank.
Yeah, and Signature as well. That's a failure of the Federal Reserve of San Francisco in the case of the Silicon Valley Bank that they never really had to answer for. They kind of said, well, you know, it's the banker's fault, which is what they regulators always say until they ask for more power. And then they say, and by the way, give us more power, even if we somehow missed the buildup of duration risk. Let's talk about the Fed, Mary. I just want to get your view. Do you think the Fed should stand pat here for a while? Or are you one of those who thinks that this is just a three-month blip and we're going to be heading down again?
You can believe both, but I do think that the Fed needs to stand pat here because there's been a lot of pressure on Jay Powell to move that target from 2% up to 3%. And I think for purposes of Fed credibility, he needs to stick by that. You know, he, as much as anybody, understands, and as he said in that clip you played, There are risks on both sides. I mean, if he stays tight for too long, he tips the economy into a recession. It may not be so easy to undo that mistake. But right now, I mean, one of the problems with central banking is all he has is the data that's put before him. And for now, I think he needs to stay put.
And Joe, I heard you say that you think Powell needs to stay put. There are some people, though, who even think maybe the next Fed move might be another increase. I have a hard time believing that would happen before the election, though. That would put the Fed in the crosshairs of Democratic politicians in the White House.
Yeah, I'm not sure I see an increase coming. But I think that, you know, an important point here is that the Fed has thought all along that the trade-off they were making was between bringing inflation down on the one hand and potentially having to force a slowdown for economic growth or the labor market on the other hand. And there isn't a lot of historical evidence that that's true. And what we have seen over the past year or so is that actually interest rates at their current level can be consistent with good economic outcomes for households, employment, economic growth, that sort of thing, at the same time that you start bringing inflation under control. So I think that the Fed should get out of this trade-off mindset that they were making and say, you know, actually, there are financial risks, like commercial real estate, as Mary mentioned, but in terms of the Main Street economy, maybe the rates at their current level aren't actually a bad thing. Maybe they are helping the economy in some important way.
No question that zero interest rates or near zero interest rates, as we had for so many years, distorted investment decisions. When money is essentially free to borrow, you tend to let your guard down about what are the best ways to allocate your money and capital. And this rate, you probably now with 5.5% Fed funds, and we get the 10-year is, I think, up to about 4.6%, 2 years now about 4.9%, you get people having to have pretty sharp calculations about what is going to allow them to get repaid if they're lending, but also return if they're investing. Let's turn to the politics of this. And with that, I want to focus on a big economic number, which is real incomes. That is, incomes, how much have they increased after inflation? Because, of course, nominal rates of income growth can be eroded to almost nothing by inflation. And that's kind of what has happened across the Biden presidency. I was looking at the data after this latest inflation report. And, of course, the last 2 months, you've seen actually no growth in real incomes. They've grown a little bit over the last year. But across the Biden presidency, they've fallen, Joe, 2.54%, according to the figures that I've seen. And if you look at actual dollars over the last year, real dollars, constant dollars, the figure from the Bureau of Labor Statistics is that the real incomes have increased the last 12 months all of 7 cents from $11.04 in 1982, $84 to $11.11. That's not a big return for a full year.
Yeah, that 7 cents, if you multiply it out over the number of hours you work in a day, it's not even enough to buy you a cup of coffee anymore. Look, I mean, this has been the political problem all along, and you could have seen it barreling down the tracks like a freight train for the past couple of years. I mean, I think that a bunch of economists and then also Democratic political strategists have been keen to argue that voters will be happy by the time November rolls around because the inflation rate is coming down. And it's undeniably true that the inflation rate has come down from its peak. But the problem is, as we have observed repeatedly on this podcast, as long as that inflation rate is positive, the price level is still going up. And so that means that households experience that price level in terms of the number of dollars that they have to pay for groceries or for gas or to heat their homes or keep the lights on or buy school supplies for the kids. And those prices have all gone up. That level is staying where it is. You know, falling inflation does not mean the prices are coming down. It just means that they are increasing less rapidly. And clearly, we see that wages are not keeping up with that. And then we're all supposed to be surprised that voters aren't happy about this. And there's this weird form of Marxism in all of this, as in Chico Marx. Who are you going to believe, your own lying eyes or me? You know, that you hear from the Democratic politicians and strategists in this debate, and then you look at these inflation data and you understand exactly why voters seem to be unhappy about the economy.
All right, we're going to take another break. When we come back, we'll talk more about the political impact of rising prices when we come back.
WSJ Special Access gives you a front row seat to some of the Wall Street Journal's most exciting content, like The Quirkier Side of Life, a new series that features the fun, surprising stories our reporters come across.
The chief executive walks 10,000 barefoot steps every day. He recalls stepping on a bee, which put him off earthing for a couple of days, but he got back to it.
Check out The Quirkier Side of Life on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker. Play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast. That is, Play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Joe Sternberg and Mary O'Grady, and talking about the political impact of inflation, and Joe's talking, Mary, about real incomes. I think the very salient point is that the powers that be in Washington, the president in particular, and I think a lot of the press corps, they've looked at a lot of the macroeconomic data, strong unemployment, strong GDP growth, and they say, man, happy days are here again. Why don't you folks get it? And their basic argument is, look, the problem isn't us. It's you. It's you American consumers. You don't get it. You don't know how good you have it. Always a dicey political argument.
Well, I think Joe put his finger on it there when he was talking about the price level, because the price level is what people are looking at. They're not looking at how much prices went up between last month and this month, but they know that since this inflation problem started, the price level is up significantly. Wages, not so much. And, you know, I think one of the things that we forget in this country, because we have not suffered the kind of inflation that, for example, you've seen in Latin America, is generally people don't catch up. You never catch up. This is why you try with everything you have at the central bank not to get in this problem. Because if you try to catch wages up to the change in the price level, you end up with a spiral. So you hold down wages to knock out the inflation problem. You know, the other thing is that I think it's just maddening for a lot of people that the Biden administration created this thing that they called the Inflation Reduction Act, which is basically throwing a lot more money into the economy in the form of subsidies. And a lot of structural things have changed. But one thing that has not changed is that inflation is still too many dollars chasing too few goods. And that's the problem that Jay Powell is trying to deal with here by draining accommodation. The fiscal side of the balance sheet, the executive, the government could help him by doing two things. One, stop throwing money into the economy in the form of subsidies. And two, do more to stimulate supply side production. We still get a lot of mixed messages from the Biden administration about energy production. And if he wants to do something about that gasoline price, he should encourage more oil drilling in this country, but he doesn't do that.
President said in a response to the March Consumer Price Index in a statement, fighting inflation remains my top economic priority. Yikes. What if it was a lower economic priority? What would have happened? But let's listen to the president give us something of a mixed message here on social spending.
We'll also restore the expanded child care tax credit, lifting millions of children out of poverty. And by the way, this helps the economy. It doesn't hurt the economy. It helps the economy. You know, our Republican friends let that expire. Well, we got to expire a couple of them politically in order to get this passed. Together, we're going to bring it back.
Together, we're going to bring that subsidy back. The president talks about subsidies across the board. I mean, the electric vehicle subsidies are going to be upwards of $1 trillion, $1 trillion over the course of several years here from the Inflation Reduction Act. And all that, Joe, has contributed to inflation. So the president, I mean, to be fair to him, this is the economic model he's grown up with. His economic advisors think so, right? It's the old spending multiplier. You get a dollar of spending and you get 1.7 dollars worth of return on growth. But what they're ignoring, first of all, that's nonsense. I think economic evidence shows that the multiplier really isn't that high. But the other thing is it discounts inflation and the impact on prices. And the president in his statement is really at pains to try to say things are just terrific. You know, prices are still too high for housing and groceries, he says, even as prices for key household items like milk and eggs are lower than a year ago. Oh my, milk and eggs are lower, but they're still up enormously from what they had been. So this is a bad political story for him.
Yes, and it is only going to get worse because, you know, as you've pointed out, Paul, he and his advisors just don't have a clear handle on what the solution was. And I mean, that solution is kind of staring us in the face. I mean, Mary described inflation as too much money chasing too few goods, and there are two solutions to that. You can reduce the amount of money that's chasing all of those goods. That's what the Fed has been trying to do. That is what the Biden administration is not doing when they create all of these subsidies that are supposed to pour out into the economy for consumption of certain goods like EVs or solar panels or any of the rest of it. But the other thing you can do is attack the other half and produce more. You know, Mary hit on one important point. You could produce more energy. You could look at tax or regulatory policies that would encourage more production in the economy. And yet that is the solution that the Biden administration and a lot of his Democratic allies steadfastly resist, even though that is also the key to unlocking real wage growth for households. You know, your wages go up in inflation-adjusted terms when the economy is more productive, but you can only get there with the kind of policies that the Biden administration is resisting so stubbornly. And so because they have those ideological blinkers on potential solutions to this problem, it's just hard to see it getting any better for them between now and the election.
Donald Trump, of course, jumped on inflation, sent out a list of all the goods and the percentage that they've increased, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, over the course of the Biden presidency. Donald Trump really isn't saying he'll control spending either, which is a problem. He's not focused on any solution himself, I think, to inflation other than to criticize Biden. Maybe he will get there before this election campaign is over. But I think just as abortion policy is emerging as the biggest Republican vulnerability in this election, inflation remains the biggest Democratic vulnerability, that and the border, I think, but inflation more than anything else. And I say that because of the fact that it affects particularly low-income voters and working-class voters because they have the less ability to get increases in wages. And they're the ones who feel it most acutely when they buy energy, buy food, the two staples of household spending, or if their rent goes up, or if their child is in their 20s and wants to buy a home. Suddenly, it's a pretty big nut if you want to borrow.
Yeah. I mean, Paul, back in the dark ages when you and I were just writing about Paul Volcker and the last big struggle
we
had.
Those were the golden ages, Mary.
There was something called the misery index where you combine the inflation with the unemployment rate. I think there's a new misery index. It's heavily still about inflation, but it's also about other things in the economic basket that are affecting people and general quality of life. So you have this inflation pressure, which means that the discretionary income in your household is shrinking. And then you're looking at crummy public schools. You're looking at crime problems. So when I think about the disadvantages that the Democrats are up against, inflation is kind of behind a lot of these other things that I would classify as quality of life. And in the end, when you do all the math, the conclusion you come to is that you're not better off under Joe Biden and you want change.
All right. I think we shall leave it there. We'll see where the inflation story goes in the coming months. It's going to be a big impact on the election, no matter which way it goes. Thanks, Mary. Thanks, Joe. Thank you all for listening. We're here every day on Potomac Watch. And thank you for listening.